scare you.
I'm going to need a microphone too because I'm a quieter speaker than my dad. He can hear him just about anywhere. So, one of my favorite stories in history is actually about George Washington. And George Washington was a man who was actually said to have a very quiet voice. And people would ask him, why are you speaking so quietly? He would say, well, it's because everybody has to lean closer to hear every word I say. So, just lean closer, I guess. But also, speaking of history, I'm going to talk a little bit about the history of the Reformation. And hopefully I won't step on too much what Paul talked about, because I find a lot of stuff will tie into what I found intriguing is about basically the coming of the Bible into the common languages. That was one issue. There were many, but as I was looking through different parts of history, I guess I'll have to confess to you right now that Reformation history is something that, you know, I have a general knowledge in, but it's not my main area of usual study. I find history is just so full. You can get a broad overview of something, but then if you start digging and getting deeper and deeper, you'll find that there's just so much stuff that has happened throughout the past. Typically, I do a lot of my study in history in mid to late 19th century American history, but you can't understand a lot of American history if you don't understand history of Reformation as well. So everything kind of just builds on top of itself. You kind of just pick a portion and just sit there. Sometimes it's hard because you want to kind of go to the cause and effect of things. Growing up, my brother and I watched a lot of the Andy Griffith Show at my grandma's house. She had this set of tapes, and one of my favorite episodes was one that was called Andy Discovers America. And they're sitting around a breakfast table one morning, and Andy's talking to his son Opie, and Opie's having problems in school, and he asks, well, what's the problem? He says, oh, it's history. I've got all this history homework. And Andy's like, well, they sure are starting awful early on history these days. And Aunt Bee pipes up, well, they've got to. There's more of it these days. So, you know, it's history is always being written every day as we go by. I find history something very intriguing to me. I really attribute that to my father and my grandfather. Both of them were lovers of history, and that's kind of been passed on to me and my brother as well. Some of my earliest memories really with Dad is sitting and watching documentaries on PBS, mostly about space exploration, because that's something we share in common a lot. It drives my wife insane whenever me and Dad get together and start talking about, you know, John Glenn and Alan Shepard and Jim Lovell and Apollo 13 and we how the rockets are working and stuff like that. So that just kind of was something that was early on in my life, and that just is still a passion, and I do believe and hope it will be a passion for the rest of my life. And the Reformation history as well, just in what I generally know and stuff I've been reading over the past week, is just like what I find in studying American history, is so deep, and there's so much that led to it that it's kind of hard to find a place to just start, because it really goes back, ultimately, you can keep going back until the creation of the world. So to jump in, it's kind of hard, but I kind of found one theme and one thread that I really enjoyed the most was about how the Reformation came about through the various forms of what it also produced. It produced a lot of men who were still very influential in our own thinking today. It produced Bibles in the common tongue. One thing I found that was very interesting was that even after the Bible was starting to be translated into common languages, the Bible was still chained to the pulpit. It was several inches to, you know, really thick, and they were chained to pulpits. And I think one great aspect or result of the Reformation is that chain really being broken, that all men everywhere could read and study for themselves. It wasn't based upon what a professional clergyman was going to tell you. It was based upon your own study as well. And I think that goes even further to the to the Reformation, even for us today, to be able to open that word in our own homes. We don't have it chained to our pulpits, and this is a Sunday morning type of Christianity which was being promoted then. It's a daily walk, and that was also a great result of the Reformation. Another thing I think that the Reformation really brought us was the one of the great doctrines is how the Scriptures are sufficient for us. You know, coming into the Reformation, especially with Martin Luther, he was dealing with a lot of man-made traditions that over the centuries had continued to build up and build up in the organized church at that time. And to be able to go, you know, to the Bible and you know, to weigh through those. Luther was a man who was a searching man. He was a man who was really looking for truth. So when he was coming and reading the Bible, he was in a very unique position because he was trained in how to read how the Bible was written at that time, primarily the Latin. So he had the opportunities to really, really study and learn from it, and that a lot of people at that time didn't have. And so, you know, God was working his heart to really convict him of a lot of things in there that he was, you know, were considered heresies at that time by the Roman Church. So, to have a good and proper doctrine of Scripture is very important. I think that was, you know, maybe what one of the catalysts of the Reformation was in the sense of, I think, of Martin Luther, was that his desire to search out the Scriptures for himself. That should be our desire today as well. Is to look to the Bible and not to, you know, take it from context and take it and to fit our own devices, but to let it shape us. One story that's always kind of stuck with me, talking about, you know, the importance of using the Scriptures properly, was from one of my spiritual mentors. I heard a lesson he gave once, and I don't even remember what the rest of the lesson was about. It was just this little part here kind of stuck with me. He was discussing, and this is also a historical story, so I found it very interesting as well. There was a preacher probably in the late 1800s that was going around, and at that time there were some fashion changes happening in America, and he was preaching against them. The women were starting to take their hair and kind of put them up in a knot on top of their head, and he was going around the country preaching, "This is against the Bible. This is a sin. You women, stop this right now." So finally, a bunch of them came up and said, "Okay, show me, where does it say this?" And he quotes Matthew 24:17. "Let him which is on the housetop not come down to take anything out of his house. Top not come down." That's why. And you know, you look at a lot of the things that had come up through the Roman Church the centuries, whenever it came up to the time of Luther, a lot of it was based on a lot of silly stuff just like that. Taking the Bible and twisting it to fit what man wanted. So that just seemed to ring so loudly in the history of the Reformation. Another thing Dad kind of mentioned was a little bit about Fox's Book of Martyrs. A lot of the reformers, or those who were trying to make Reformation-type changes, especially with either the Bible or theology, a lot of those were killed. A lot of them were burned at the stake. Some were killed, buried, and later on kings would dig up their bones and throw them in the rivers and burn the bones and all sorts of things. It was a great time of spiritual uproar, and those who were going to fight against the work of God's people were trying to do whatever they could, and they really had no success in the end, because they could not stop it, because they could not stop the advancement of God's work. Here recently, Matter of fact, this past week, Brittany and I have been studying through the second Psalm, and just last night we were reading, and I was reading a little bit through Charles Spurgeon's Treasury of David, and one of the verses talking about basically God sitting in heaven laughing, my all-time favorite verse, just because I find it very interesting that God sits in his power, in his place of authority, and just finds that the devices of man so utterly stupid and silly, and we think that we've come up with the greatest thing ever. So I just always have found that verse very intriguing, one of my favorites. But talking a lot about, you know, those who basically shake their fist in the face of God. And one, he included a quote from somebody, I can't remember who it was, and I wish I had that with me now. But he talked about a lot of the Roman emperors that were persecuting the early church. And he went through a very lengthy and graphic explanation of what happened to each of those rulers. There were ones that died by the sword, some that died by diseases where they were basically eaten by parasites from the inside out. There were ones that were killed by various different means. Some, and my favorite one says, this one emperor, I can't remember what his name was, died by a device of which is too horrible for me to even mention. You know, and there's some pretty gruesome stuff he was already mentioning, like, wow, what was that? You know. So we see God's providential hand through history, and you know, the coming of the Reformation was really just a continuation of him working through the hearts of men, fallen men who by no means are perfect. You know, that's one cautionary thing I usually think about when, you know, we're discussing people like Luther or people like John Calvin or John Knox, or, you know, these men gave us some great theological things to think and ponder, but they were still men. They are not perfect. They did not get everything right, just as we will never get everything right. But yet, to learn from their failures and learn from their successes is something that's what history does for us. You know, there's kind of a thought of history out there, and this happens a lot, where we tend to kind of go and look at history and pick out what we like and kind of sit there and put those sorts of people on the pedestal, and the history where something bad has happened, well, we know it's there, but we don't want to delve into it. Well, it's good to see what man does, good or bad, so that we can better learn where we're going, because history repeats itself. Nothing is new under the sun, that's what it says in Ecclesiastes. A lot of things that we see today is nothing new. We find things happening in our society and culture today that happened in other societies and cultures in centuries and millennia past. So it's a lot of times easy to find out what outcomes will be if we just looked at what outcomes in the past were. And the outcomes of the Reformation show a lot of great things, and there are even some things that were very concerning that were even happening during the Reformation. You're dealing with a time of great turmoil in the civilized world, and anytime something like that happens, there's just you never know what the reactions of people will be, because a lot of people just like to jump on bandwagons, and that happened during the Reformation as well as many other great religious awakenings. A lot of people are just caught up in the spirit of the moment, and just because it can happen. And on that subject, kind of going to Martin Luther, I recently listened to, over the past several months, kind of on and off, I've been listening to a lecture series by R.C. Sproul on Luther and the Reformation. And some interesting things that I learned and gained from that about Luther and the coming of the Reformation. First of all, his opus, the 95 Theses, was basically a basic response to Johann Tetzel and the selling of indulgences. Selling indulgences also to buy basically departed loved ones out of purgatory. And due to Martin Luther's growing love for the scriptures, he was searching them and saying, there is no biblical basis at all for this. Why is this happening? One issue why something like that would happen was that this is a period where Bibles were chained to the pulpits, and it was in a language that was a dead language. Only the very elite educated clergy knew how to read. So you were at the complete will of who was standing up there and speaking. And in that time, a lot of even just common people could not read any language. So you were very much determined upon the professional elite to be able to give you this information. Thus, the many heresies coming up, one of them the selling of indulgences. Now, I think at one point Luther made a journey to Rome. It was kind of a pilgrimage that a lot were considered good to do, because there you were going to where the established church was headquartered. And he was going, he was seeing these indulgences being sold, and really kind of vexing his soul, thinking, why is this happening? I find the character of Johann Tetzel to be very intriguing to me for several reasons. The main reason is because I work in advertising. And Johann Tetzel was probably one of the world's greatest marketers ever. In the advertising industry, the TV industry, we sometimes sell little jingles to companies for exorbitant amounts of money, by the way. These little jingles, as corny as they may sound, had a lot of money behind them. And the reason that they do that is because it's really easy for you to get a song stuck in your head. Those few little lines of, you know, whatever thing, whatever product being sold, and there's probably jingles from many years past that you can remember every word to, because it gets stuck in your head. And once that gets stuck in your head, they got you, because you're thinking of their product. Well, Tetzel had his little rhyming saying, whenever a coin in the copper rings, the soul from purgatory springs. We all know that today pretty much too. That was nearly 500 years ago. Whenever a coin in the copper rings, a soul from purgatory springs. So here he had a really good marketing campaign going, because, boy, he had that in people's heads. And they were worried about that. This was bugging people, because this was being taught from the church, who people are thinking, well, this must be right, because I've just heard it from the church. So Luther's thesis were basically mostly in question of that. He was basically writing those as a way to debate with his colleagues in Wittenberg. It was a college town. They were training men for the clergy there. And so he was like, let's get together, everybody. Let's talk about this, because here's some issues. Where's this coming from? Because I don't see this within our Bibles. Let's get together and talk about this. So he goes and he nails it to the door of the church. Now, we always kind of think of a big Hollywood, you know, he's going up the steps and the orchestra's playing, and he's, you know, he hits the hammer and you can hear it echoing across the whole street. Well, the church door was basically the community bulletin board. People put stuff on that church door all the time that for whatever events might be going on. So he was just making a public proclamation. All you intellectuals, here's what of course, you know, we don't see announcements like this that are 95 points long, and, you know, people don't make announcements like that anymore on anything. But he was just trying to get them all together. Let's get together and let's talk about this. Let's have a good intellectual discussion and debate. First of all, no one came. No one wanted to talk with them about it, because you're dealing with people who, a lot of people dealing with fear of the power of the Roman Church, which was a church and state type of government institution, which had a lot of power, a lot of money behind it. You know, what Luther was doing was insanity. This was treasonous in those days. But the word spread not through debates, but it spread, once again, it's a college town, through a lot of younger people. Within, I can't remember what it was, not a very long time, maybe a few months, maybe not even that. The thesis had been copied, recopied, and you could find it in just about every town in the surrounding countryside in a matter of very short amount of time. People were discussing this, and a lot of it was due to these younger people, college type students, we would say today, copying this. And I kind of thought about that. I kind of wondered what their motives were, because you can look at the history of America and many other places. A lot of social revolutions have happened around colleges, and a lot of times it's because they're thinking, we're the young blood. We're gonna make all the changes, and we're gonna revolt against the old society and start the new. And so, I don't know what their hearts were in doing this. If they were just thinking, here we go. Here's when we can give the Pope a good old smack on the nose and start our new social revolution. I don't know what their hearts were in that, or if they were really, convicted of these things, saying, these are true. There probably were some. And there probably were some just that were jumping on the bandwagon because it was something new, something that was going that was just the end thing to be doing is to find some other way to rebel against established authorities at that time. So that was I found very, very just kind of an interesting thought on how that all started. I mean, by the time that Luther's writing these, what he's greatest known for is his doctrine of the justification by faith. He had not come to that at this point when he wrote these. He was still, very much, being trained in the Roman Church clergy, still very much, attached to that. But he was seeing that with this selling of the indulgences, that something was wrong here, and the little warning sirens were going off in his head. Beside Luther, which we go to Luther and we look at him as the one who started the Reformation with his nailing of those onto the door in Wittenberg. It goes back a lot farther in those who kind of helped set it up as well. Those who had kind of fought against the Roman Church. And I was kind of looking through some of them, and like I said, a lot of these you can also find in Fox's Book of Martyrs because they were killed for their beliefs. Early on, this is more than 100 years before Luther, is John Wycliffe. And Wycliffe was the one who was probably the first English language Bible, and it was handwritten. This is before the printing press, so he was handwriting English Bibles at that time, translating, he was also very sought after by the Roman Church because what he was doing was also considered an illegal act. I have one note I have here. The Pope was so infuriated by his teachings and his translation of the Bible in English that 44 years after Wycliffe had died, he ordered the bones to be dug up, crushed, and scattered in the river. Coming along just about another 80 years later is Johann Gutenberg. God raised him up in his inventive mind to really change the world. Because now you could print, you could mass produce printing. Another interesting story about this period in time, a lot of people know the Dark Ages. And one of the reasons it's called the Dark Ages is because we don't have a whole lot of knowledge on what went on during that period. It's kind of a vague period. And one person I've heard has attributed that to the invention of the printing press, saying it's one of the greatest inventions ever given, but yet one of the worst. Because what happened was that before that, you had handwritten manuscripts. Well, the printing press came out. Wow, this new technology is so cutting edge. We don't need our handwritten books anymore. And a lot of them were lost, destroyed, thrown away, burned. And so a lot of knowledge was lost, too. And you think about that today in our ever-changing technological society where now everything goes digital, you can hold it in your hand. What knowledge will 500 years from now be lost because we've all put it on our phones? So, just like I guess with any technological invention, there's always good, there's always evil. So, let's use them for good in ways that Gutenberg did as well. His first printing was a German Bible, but that brought about the ability to print other Bibles, other literature, and that to be continue to be be passed down and mass produced to where it basically made it impossible for those who were trying to stop any sort of translation of the Bible. They just couldn't keep up with it because they were just coming out so fast that they couldn't destroy them as fast as they were being produced. Another, and this was actually somebody I was thinking originally about just speaking on. I talked speaking about how complex and how detailed history can be. I was reading about William Tyndale, and he was basically, he was right, you know, in the same time era as Luther, though he was translating in English. Tyndale's interesting because we kind of consider him the architect of the English language. Because a lot of phrases that he came up with while translating from the original languages into English were invented by him. Because he had to figure out, okay, well, here's this term in Hebrew. How am I going to convey this in English? I was doing a little bit of reading this morning about translation from Hebrew and the difficulty of that. Because Hebrew language is different than ours in that one word can more evoke an emotion rather than a meaning. So sometimes it's hard to figure out how to get that emotion that's kind of underneath of a word to go through. Sometimes it had to end up being a phrase of words rather than just one single word because there was no equivalent to such a word in the English language. So a lot of what Tyndale did was really shape how we talk today and write and think. Because he had to take these things that really, you know, hadn't been, you know, a whole, hadn't been done very much. It was, you know, considered illegal to do. Some other interesting things about Tyndale is this speaking about mass production of books. His New Testaments were often confiscated. They would be rounded up in towns. They would find where they were and they would burn them. But eventually, copies ended up in the bedroom of King Henry VIII. You know, a complete enemy of God, and one who was saying that we need to go and burn these things. But somehow a copy ended up in his own bedroom as well. The king and also the bishops there were resisting this distribution because the public was fascinated by this. Here they were able to read this in their own language as well. The church declared that these English Bibles contained thousands of errors, and they torched the New Testaments that they were able to confiscate. One funny thing is that a lot of these Bibles that were being sold by Tyndale and those that were working with him were... a lot of the clergy were going on buying them from people. Like, we will give you money if you will round these up. And so they would sometimes go out and have their own people, Tyndale's people, going out and selling Bibles to the bishops to be burned to use the money to make more Bibles. So they're basically, the enemy was funding their own, you know, war, basically, the other side's cause, because they were selling to the enemy to be burned and to make more, because apparently it was a lot... they were worth a lot more to those who were seeking them than they were to produce. So they had a pretty good little niche market going there. What kind of happened after with Luther and eventually going to places like Geneva was a really just an amazing story of God using various people from various backgrounds. Even sometimes using rulers who wouldn't have been very sympathetic to the cause, but yet still softening their hearts enough to let them live. And sometimes working the other way and having those who were trying to do the reforming work to be killed. It's just an amazing story of just how that brought about such a change in the world. And, you know, like I said, with my own passion for American history, you can't understand the history of our country if you don't understand the Reformation, because it was based on a lot of those issues that this country ended up being settled. the first permanent settlements here being from the pilgrims who brought with them Geneva Bibles, which was translated in conjunction with John Calvin and John Knox in Geneva, Switzerland. And it also was a little bit of a precursor to our own to the King James Bible. Matter of fact, I think I have somewhere here that it was, you know, like 95% the same, though they were using different texts to translate it with. The King James Bible being, they had a few texts that were more so from more of Roman Catholic traditions, but yet still ended up being a very, very accurate translation. The Geneva Bible being the first that had chapters and verses, because they felt it would be easier to study, to be able to go point to point. Also had very extensive marginal notes, was what we call a study Bible today, that were written as well. That was carried into the first people to settle here, and the pilgrims came here basically out of a religious persecution. Also, because they were trying to establish a Christian society, I guess you would say. They were in a very pagan society before they came here in Holland, and as a result, we're seeing a lot of their children adopt the principles of that culture they're living in, and being against their Christian religion, they felt it's time to pick up and move, and let's go to a place where anything that's been written about it is where people will die. You will be eaten alive, they were told, by the natives there. Anything that had come back from the New World at that time was just a bad report. And so they said, okay, let's go. would we do that today? I sometimes think about that myself. Would I pick up and go someplace because I felt like that was going to be the best for my family, the upbringing of the religious bringing of my family. They were a direct result of still that Reformation spirit of trying to say we are to obey God rather than man. The scriptures are much higher than any law of man, and we want to teach our children that. So that's where we have our foundations here. Once again, very, very closely related to that Reformation mindset. So, in conclusion, the Reformation just has so much depth in its history. It's a very colorful history as well, that and we can be thankful for all that has happened through it. And we can be thankful that God used these fallible men, these men that had a lot to learn, that He used them for such good. And that for us to forget these deeds is really unacceptable. We should constantly go back to these stories of old and first of all give thanks that they happen. Give thanks to God's working for them, and also to learn from what these people either went through or what thoughts they had, to see how that applies in our own lives. The Reformation really, personally to me, means that the work should never stop. We don't stop at one point and say, there, figured it out. I've often wondered this, and I don't know this for a fact. I'd like to look more into this, but I often wonder what someone like Martin Luther would think when today he knew that there was a Christian organization called the Lutherans. I wonder if he would go and say, wait a second, I'm a man, and I still have a lot to learn. Or someone like John Calvin, when a whole religious systematic theology called Calvinism. If he would say, why name that after me, a fallible man who did not figure out everything in my lifetime? We don't know that. I wonder what they would say to us now. I wonder if they would say, have the spirit that we had of searching the scriptures and wanting to know what they have to say to us, and keep doing it and don't stop. Because the second we stop and become stagnant, become comfortable, is whenever the enemy will attack us the hardest, because then we're off our guard. And we've seen now, especially in present day, a lot of Christian denominations accepting a lot of wicked, wicked things because they've become stagnant. They've lost that Reformation spirit to continually search these truths and to apply them. And I think that's what the Reformation mostly says to us, and that's what the history teaches us, is that we should be about that mind and that determination. We should be the ones still out there mining through these scriptures, and we should still be going out and nailing theses to community doors, calling those around us, calling our governments, calling our churches, calling our businesses, our individual citizens, everybody, back to the Bible. That's what it was all about. That's what Martin Luther was doing in the end, was just calling people into accountability to the Word of God. So, I really, really just found in the few things that I was able to study this week to prepare for this, just how much I don't know, and how much more I would like to know. And just to take, just one of these people, Luther or Tyndale or Wycliffe, you could study for the rest of your life and never be able to really get a good grasp of these people. And it's just a wonderful thing that we've been given through history, even more so through the Word of God, that we have these written accounts to be able to learn from and to be able to continue to pass on. I've heard it said once, talking about those who were considered great heroes of the faith. A lot of times you don't know who the people were that are persecuting them at the time. Or you do know who they are, but they're not held in very good light. One person I think of is Corrie ten Boom, who we know of through the persecution in Germany during World War II. During her time, nobody knew who she was. She was in a prison camp. Nobody knew that name until afterwards. Everybody knew who Adolf Hitler was. They knew that there was the high command there. They knew that there was persecution to the Jews and those who would harbor them. But no one knew her name during that period. But afterwards, who's considered the hero? People like her. And the one who's considered the villain are the ones that were persecuting. So, it's just the continual passing of history is so intriguing like that, because it shows us just how amazing God works. And then when those things are revealed, we can be so thankful for it. If her story had never been told, how different would our world maybe have been? And our understanding of that period of time. And it kind of makes you wonder now, who is out there right now who is the nobody? Nobody knows that within 50, 60, 100 years, people may be saying, wow, what a great man or great woman of faith for what they stood for in the area that they were given to have an influence over through the help of the Spirit of God. So may that be said of all of us. May the Reformation Spirit always be a part of us. And as we continue to go through history ourselves and write that history with God directing that, may we be said that we are ones that never bowed to the opinions of man, but we bowed to the King of Kings, and that we stood by His words, and that we stood faithful to the end.